I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Five states allow doctors to assist terminally ill patients with dying: Oregon, Washington, Montana, Vermont, and New Mexico. As the Maryland General Assembly considers allowing doctors to prescribe lethal medications, we take a look at both sides of the right to die debate. Some call it death with dignity, others see it as physician-assisted suicide. We'll hear from a representative of the organization that supported Brittany Maynard, the young woman with brain cancer, who made national news last fall when she moved to Oregon so she could legally end her life. We'll also hear from a member of Not Dead Yet, a group that opposes assisted suicide and worries that it puts the elderly and people with disabilities at risk. That's Midday after the news from NPR. And welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF out in Frederick, and Hagerstown, and WYPO, serving the eastern shore of Maryland and Ocean City, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. We again thank you for making Midday part of your day. The right to die, physician-assisted suicide, death with dignity, euthanasia. There are many names for the legislation that Maryland's General Assembly is considering this session, legislation that would allow terminally ill patients to obtain a doctor's prescription for medication to end their lives. The right to die debate received much publicity late last year when Brittany Maynard, a 29-year-old California woman with terminal brain cancer, publicly announced her decision to move to Oregon in order to legally end her life. Currently, five states allow terminally ill patients to have a doctor's assistance in dying: Oregon, Washington, Montana, Vermont, and New Mexico. Besides Maryland, at least three other states, California, Wyoming, Pennsylvania, and the District of Columbia, are also considering right-to-die legislation. In this hour, we'll speak to Samantha Crane, a board member of Not Dead Yet, a disability rights organization that opposes assisted suicide, and Brandy Alexander, regional campaign manager for the Maryland branch of Compassion and Choices, which supports legislation to allow terminally ill patients to choose to end their lives with a doctor's assistance. Maryland outlawed assisted suicide in 1999, 2 weeks after Jack Kevorkian, the medical pathologist who helped patients end their lives, was found guilty of second-degree murder for assisting in the death of a man with Lou Gehrig's disease. More recently, a Hamden doctor, Lawrence Egbert, was stripped of his medical license for his alleged involvement in the deaths of six Maryland residents. Dr. Egbert does not face criminal charges here, but admitted that he was with more than a dozen Marylanders and 100 people nationwide during their deaths. The Right to Die bill in the House of Delegates in Maryland was sponsored by Delegate Shane Pendergrass of Howard County. In order to qualify, patients must be competent, have a terminal illness with 6 months or less to live, and ask their doctor, who has the right to decline, three separate times for the prescription. Supporters of the bill, and there's a bill in the Senate as well, supporters of the bills believe that doctors should respect a patient's end-of-life choices, even if that includes death. They argue that forcing people to keep living when they may be in chronic pain and suffering is inhumane. Opponents point out the danger for abuse or coercion, especially of the elderly or disabled, and the potential for a misdiagnosis of a terminal illness. They also question whether the bills go far enough to screen potential patients. A recent poll from Goucher College found that 60% of Marylanders supported allowing terminally ill patients to obtain a doctor's prescription for a fatal dose of drugs. However, the bills in Annapolis face opposition from the State Board of Physicians and Governor Larry Hogan. If you'd like to join us in conversation during this hour of the show, please give us a ring, 410-662-8780, or write your thoughts about this in an email and send it to us during the hour. I'll read it. Please try to keep your comments brief, midday@wypr.org. You can also tweet comments on Twitter. We're at MiddayWYPR on Twitter, or just Dan Rodericks. First, I'd like to welcome to the show Brandy Alexander from Compassion and Choices, which is supporting this bill. Brandy, nice to have you on the show.
Thank you so much.
So Maryland currently has a law that went into effect back when Paris Glendening was governor that outlaws physician-assisted suicide. So what's the distinction here? Would your bill repeal physician-assisted suicide? You don't actually like that term, so I'm giving you an opportunity to explain what this bill, the Death with Dignity Act, does.
Yeah, thank you. I'll start by saying what Death with Dignity is not. I think that's important. Assisted suicide statues were designed for people who are mentally unbalanced and may kill themselves in violent ways, where this statute that we're pushing for actually would allow a patient who's already dying to end their life. So the distinction is that a person who is doing assisted suicide has the choice to live, whereas these people don't have the choice to live. If they could choose to live, they would. But the fact of the matter is the illness is taking their life.
So a doctor has to certify that someone has less than 6 months to live.
That's correct.
Okay. And you heard me mention some of the criteria here that I outlined. That's all accurate as far as you know what I said.
Yes.
Terminal illness was 6 months or less to live. Ask their doctor. That's interesting. At least 3 times for a prescription.
That's correct.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, the first request is oral, and that's just a discussion with your physician telling them that you're interested in this option. The second request is in writing and signed by the patient and as well as 2 qualified witnesses. So that's a safeguard that's been put in place to try to help make sure that there's no coercion. And thirdly, the request is oral and at least 15 days after the initial request.
15 days after the initial request.
And okay. At least 48 hours after the written request.
What else does it specify, Brandy? What other restrictions or limitations might you mention?
Only the patient themselves can request the medication. And
that gets me to the question of competency. Is there a provision in there for the competency of the patient to ask for a prescription?
There is. If the two physicians, there have to be 2 physicians that verify that the person is mentally competent. And if there is any question between either one of those physicians, then there is a referral process to a mental health professional that can verify that.
Your group is Compassion and Choices, which is actually a national group working on this across the country. And so this is yours is the Maryland chapter of this.
Correct.
What brought you to this, Brandy? Do you have a personal story?
I do have a personal story. I actually began working in the Denver office of Compassion and Choices. And in 2011, my father's cancer came out of remission. And I'd worked in this, working in these issues for 7 years at that time, and I'd never had even one conversation with my own father about what his wishes are. So it really brought to the forefront to me how important it is to have conversations with your family and at least know what they want.
Had you talked to anyone in your family about this? They knew what you did for a living, right?
I have not. I even did a presentation at our family reunion encouraging everyone to do advanced directives and sharing with them our Good to Go toolkit that has like a values worksheet and other things that really help your wishes be known. And I hadn't talked to my own parents with a terminal father.
So you worked for Compassion and Choices or another organization?
Compassion and Choices. I've been there 10 years.
All through that time?
Correct.
So you never had this conversation with your own dad?
I didn't.
What was his name?
His name was Ferdinand Alexander. And it came to a point where he couldn't speak for himself, and he was remarried, and his wife was his power of attorney, and we didn't agree what she thought, and she didn't agree what we thought, but the fact of the matter is we didn't know what he wanted. So it was really eye-opening for me.
What was the split in the family? What did his wife want?
His wife thought he would want more aggressive
treatment,
whereas we thought the amount of pain he is and how I've never seen my father cry, and that was the first time I ever saw him cry in pain. So, you know, emotions are high. Everyone thinks they know what's best, and it was just an ugly situation that could have been avoided had we had that conversation.
How old was he at the time?
He was 62.
And you say he couldn't speak for himself.
Yes, he was
physically unable to speak?
Physically unable, yeah. He was unresponsive. So
at that point, you couldn't get an answer from him about what he wanted.
It was too late.
That was in the state of Colorado?
In Louisiana.
That was in Louisiana.
Yeah, my father's fine.
So there was no option going to a doctor and saying.
No, there weren't.
But even then, if your law were to pass in Maryland in that case, even you couldn't ask.
No.
You couldn't ask for
absolutely
a physician's
not.
Assistance with a lethal dose.
No.
Only your
only
father
he
could
would
do
have been able to do that. And I don't know if he would have made that choice, but it would have been amazing if he had that option with the amount of pain that he was going through at that time.
So this all has to happen at the end of life after a diagnosis and a prognosis of terminal illness for 6 months. This is not something you can write in a will.
No.
Years ahead of time.
No. Advanced directives are great because they do let you say whether you want to be resuscitated, about feeding tubes, discontinuing life support and things of that sort. But with a terminal diagnosis, those are things that you can't really predict. What we found is that people who do make this option, it gives them such peace of mind once they know that they do have a way if it comes to a point that it's unbearable for them.
410-662-8780 is our phone number here if you'd like to join us. And I have a question for Brandy Alexander from Compassion and Choices supporting the Death with Dignity Act in Maryland. Now we turn to Samantha Crane, joining us by phone, a board member of Not Dead Yet, which has great concerns about this and is wants to take an opportunity here to express them on our show. So, Samantha, thank you for joining us on Midday.
Hi. Thank you for having me. And I'm sorry that my voice is a little bit scratchy today.
Oh.
But I want to emphasize that the disability community is overwhelmingly opposed to physician-assisted suicide and has been for many years. Every major nationwide disability organization that's taken a position on this issue has decided to oppose. And there are a few reasons that really make sense that when you take into context that people with disabilities often have complex medical conditions and may experience near to end of life moments throughout their lives. Unfortunately, although there is a sort of a six-month prognosis requirement, many people with disabilities will know that these are notoriously unreliable. In 2011, we got a report that about 200,000 people that year were discharged alive from hospice care. And hospice care, like this bill, requires doctors to believe that someone has 6 months or less to live. So that's 200,000 people every year in the U.S. who might be found eligible for physician-assisted suicide, but in fact go on to live despite medical prognoses.
What is your particular concern about people with disabilities? Let's talk about that for a moment.
Well, people with disabilities are often are particularly likely to have these recurrent medical conditions that can lead to these six-month prognoses. So we have a lot of experience with outliving prognoses that doctors might have given us.
Mm-hmm.
We also note that in the statistics we're seeing from Oregon, most people are citing disability associated with their illness and not unmanaged pain as a reason for physician-assisted suicide. Doctors are not necessarily always aware that when someone is facing a disability for the first time, it's incredibly common to feel depressed and suicidal and to believe that, you know, my life is not worth living, I'm a burden on my family, it is not worth living if I have to, you know, have assistance bathing or eating. And those feelings, actually, with adequate support, including mental health support, pain control, and independent living supports, those feelings end up going away and people end up enjoying the remainder of their lives.
Samantha, have you documented cases of people in those states where it's now legal, Oregon, Washington, Montana, Vermont, and New Mexico, people with disabilities who received a prognosis and then, had arranged for a physician's assistance and then recovered? I mean, do you have examples of that?
Yeah, actually, so for example, one of my colleagues in Maryland received two separate six-month prognoses, was in hospice care for a while. This was not, unfortunately, in a state with physician-assisted suicide, or fortunately for her, it was not in a state with physician-assisted suicide because otherwise, she might have considered it. But she outlived those prognoses by decades. despite having been placed in hospice care and withdrawn a lot of the life-sustaining treatment that was expected to extend her life.
Hmm. We'll go back to Brittany on this. Brittany Alexander, I'll give you. I'm sorry, I said Brandy Alexander. You think I'd remember that name, Brandy Alexander? I'll go back to you from Compassionate Choices, and Samantha will stay on the line so we can hear from her some more. But I'll give you a chance to respond to what she said so far, and then we need to take a little break.
Yeah, I think that there are fair concerns, but I think that's why we're so grateful to have Oregon and their experience, and they've been doing this for 18 years. And over those 18 years, there's not been one case of, someone with a disability being taken advantage of by this law. And I also think it's important to note that it's a patient's decision. It's for them to decide when it's the time. So a doctor may tell you you have 6 months to live, but if you're not feeling like it's your time, then you don't have to do it. It's just having that peace of mind to know that if it comes to the point where it's unbearable, that you can do it. So I think that it's been also the second year in Vermont, which is the only state that's passed this law through the legislature. And they have not experienced that so far either. So I think that this bill has gone out of its way to make sure that there are safeguards in place so that no one can be forced to do this. It is definitely a decision a person makes on their own.
When you say Vermont passed the law through its legislature, what about the other states? Was it a referendum or something?
Yes, Washington and Oregon were referendums, and Montana and New Mexico actually went through a lawsuit, like using constitutional clauses.
Huh. Thank you very much. Brandy Alexander from Compassion and Choices, and on the line with us, Samantha Crane of Not Dead Yet. We're talking about the Death with Dignity Act that's proposed in the Maryland legislature. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, ask a question, tell a story. Give us your opinion of this. 410-662-8780. How do you feel about this? The Goucher poll said 60% of Marylanders support this idea of a doctor being allowed to provide a prescription for medication to end the life of a terminally ill patient. How do you feel about it? 410-662-8780. It's the Midday Show. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here with Brandy Alexander, who represents Compassion and Choices, the group that's supporting the Death with Dignity Act in the Maryland legislature. And Samantha Crane is on the phone with us, a board member of Not Dead Yet, a disability rights organization that opposes physician-assisted suicide. And Brandy, before we go on, we didn't finish talking about your dad. Your father died. How much longer did he live after that sequence that you were describing about the split in the family?
About a month later, he passed away, January 11th.
Yeah.
And it was that we just, there was so much dissension within our family, we weren't able to honor his death. Mm-hmm. We spent his last days arguing. So it's just a lesson about how important it is to talk about these things, regardless of what the end conclusion is.
And Samantha Crane, I want to go back to you here, because your argument seems to turn on, what would you say, a lack of accuracy about the prognosis for terminal a terminal diagnosis. That's one thing. You're concerned about lack of screening for patients who just might be depressed. Is that another?
Mm-hmm. And actually, we're very concerned about safeguards. And I was surprised that Brandy said there was not one case in Oregon of someone with a disability being taken advantage of, because actually, I can list several cases in Oregon of a person with a disability being taken advantage of, and those are just ones that made the news. Unfortunately, Oregon's Department of Health does not investigate individual physician-assisted suicide cases, so they certainly can't say that they've investigated these cases and found that there was no wrongdoing. But I can list you two cases of someone who had an illness-related disability and were shopped around to different doctors until they found one that was willing to write the prescription, where in the first couple doctors said the person is depressed, doesn't have the capacity to make this choice. They ended up going to a different doctor, or their child brought them to a different doctor who was willing to write the prescription, and that is extremely concerning to us.
What about the Maryland legislation in that regard, Brandy? Is there does it ban doctor shopping? I mean, do you have to go to your primary care physician or your oncologist to get a prescription? How does that it speak to that?
Most of the time when someone has a terminal disease, they have a physician that they have worked with. So ideally you would work with that physician, but if that physician's not willing to assist you, then there are referrals that are in place, because if this is something that an individual wants, they should be allowed to have it. But we don't want to force anyone to do it, not physicians, not pharmacists, nor individuals. So it is possible that a physician said no, but what is written in here is that the physician who does say no is required to transfer all of the medical records to a physician who was willing.
I see. Okay. We'll take a couple more calls here, 410-662-8780. Let's start right in and hear from our listeners on this. You're welcome to give us a ring and share your opinion. Mary, calling from Ocean City. Nice to have you on the show. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I had a husband who died of pancreatic cancer a few years ago, and I am so happy for his memory that there is someone standing up for the rights of cancer patients. My concern is that the cancers sometimes are so aggressive so quickly that even though he had a living will stipulating that he didn't want resuscitative efforts, his condition changed very quickly as his cancer became very aggressive. And as I understand it, what's before our legislature requires that the patient make the request. I'm concerned that the power of attorney does not have that power to speak on behalf of the patient when they are unable to do so, to follow through with their wishes. The second point is the waiting of, I believe, 15 days after the initial verbal, inquiry by the patient and then follow-up documentation in writing.
Right.
I'm just wondering, why is there this rote waiting time? Is that to prove that there wasn't any duress? I mean, you go to buy a car and you have less than that to return the car in the state of Maryland. Why this 15-day wait? Cancer can be so aggressive and put the patient in such agony in that period of time that they become unresponsive. So I'll take the answers off the air.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Keep going.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary.
And get this passed in Maryland.
All right. Thank you, Mary. So two questions there for Brandy, Alexander. The power of attorney, this idea that somebody else could request a lethal dosage from a doctor for a person who can no longer, you know, like in your father's case, right?
Right. And we have heard from people who are supportive of this that this bill doesn't go far enough. But we found that it needs to be the individual that makes the request. I mean, that I think could play into some of the fears that people have of coercion if the power of attorney could make those decisions. It's really important that it's the individual themselves.
And explain the 15-day wait again for our listeners and address what Mary's concerned about that.
Yes. It can be trying for someone who's terminal to have to wait, and oftentimes patients don't make it through that waiting period. But it is yet again another safeguard put in place to try to make sure that coercion is not happening.
How much is the Maryland bill, this legislation in the House and the Senate, modeled after the Oregon law?
It's very, very similar to the Oregon law. The people who drafted it took the Oregon, Washington, Vermont, and Connecticut bills and took the best features of them all, and those are all based on Oregon. So pretty much the only difference between the Oregon bill and the Maryland bill is that the Oregon bill requires a reporting of the medication to the Department of Health, and that is not in the Maryland bill. But all of the main important safeguards are still there, with the person having to be terminal, mentally competent, and able to self-administer.
We'll go back to Samantha. Samantha Crane, did you want to respond to anything you've heard in the last few minutes?
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly the kind of concern that we would have, that if people, you know, first you have cases where someone is asking for physician-assisted suicide. We've seen in jurisdictions that have legalized physician-assisted suicide, like Netherlands, that it very quickly became impossible for them to hold the line against people trying to request physician-assisted suicide for people who, you know, were not able to express their wishes, perhaps had never been able to express their wishes in the case of people with developmental disabilities. And it just very quickly gets to the point where people are making life or death decisions for people who have never expressed any interest in dying at all.
That's the voice of Samantha Crane, a board member of Not Dead Yet, a disability rights organization that opposes a physician-assisted suicide. Brandi Alexander is regional campaign manager for the Maryland branch of Compassion and Choices, which supports the Death with Dignity Act in the Maryland legislature. Let's take another call. Alan in Baltimore County, out in Owings Mills. Welcome to Midday, Alan.
Yes, thank you. I was a hospice social worker for about 8 years, and I was even conceding Samantha's claim of 200,000 people being discharged from hospice, and I don't concede that number. It sounds outrageously large. But anyway, she clearly doesn't understand hospice practice because many, many, many people who are in hospice have to be discharged from hospice to get treatment for other conditions unrelated to their dying, their prognosis. And because Medicare won't and insurance won't pay for hospice while they're getting this treatment, they are discharged. They go to the hospital or wherever it is they're going to get the treatment. They get that treatment. Then they're readmitted to hospice. So that figure includes a huge number of people who are not finished with hospice because they're not dying. In my 8 years, I don't know, I think I saw maybe three people who were discharged because their conditions actually cleared up or went into remission, I guess is more to the point, or for other reasons. Sometimes people withdraw from hospice for personal reasons or family reasons. But it's just simply not correct that the 6 month diagnosis is usually correct. And I heard testimony in Annapolis over and over again, well, that's not right, it's not. Even a doctor said that. But I can tell you in my experience, the people in hospice who get a six-month diagnosis, they die within the 6 months. I mean, this is just a distortion of the facts.
All right. Thank you very much, Alan. Samantha, I'll let you respond to that if you wish.
Yeah. So I got this number from the U.S. Inspector General responsible for Medicare. Even if you believe that some of these people are being discharged from hospice in order to get treatment for another condition, I can also tell you that about 21% of patients who are admitted to hospice stay longer than 180 days. So that's about 21% of people outliving a six-month prognosis. Are they dying? Are they eventually going to die? Yes, maybe, but maybe they'll die in a year, maybe they'll die in 2 years. It's simply not possible to say that someone is going to definitely die in 6 months.
Our phone number here for the Midday Show is 410-662-8780. We would sure like to hear from Marylanders here about this bill, these two bills in the House and Senate, the Death with Dignity Act that's been proposed in the legislature. What do you think about this? Do you call it physician-assisted suicide, death with dignity, whatever term you use? What do you think about it? 410-662-8780. Do you think doctors should have the legal authority in Maryland to do this and not be prosecuted if they assisted a patient with less than 6 months to live with death, with a lethal dosage? Now, here's a question that goes back to the one earlier about doctor shopping. How do we know that doctors will want to do this in Maryland? Brandi, do you have any information on how many doctors in the state of Oregon, for instance, actually do this? Do all doctors do it as part of their practice now? What can you say about that?
Yeah, the Oregon Department of Health does keep these numbers annually, and they put out a report that shows that. And usually it's between 60 to 80 physicians that have participated and around just over 100 requests for it.
Each year. About 100 requests and 60 to 80 doctors who, take part in it each year?
Correct.
Or actually provide a prescription?
Yes.
Okay.
So it seems to spread out throughout the state. And so this is a really small number of people that we're talking about. But for that small number of people, it means everything to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important to note the only role that the physician has is prescribing, nothing else beyond that. So using the term physician assisted also is a little bit inaccurate because the physician doesn't assist, which I think also goes with the definition of euthanasia and mercy killings and all of these things. It requires a third party to participate. This is all completely self-administered.
Okay, that gets to an issue I wanted to bring up here, and maybe Samantha Crane wants to speak to it too. A letter from Archbishop William Lurie of Baltimore, the Archbishop of Baltimore, who opposes this Death with Dignity Act and raises the point about the laws or the legislation's lack of a requirement that a doctor or nurse be present when the lethal drugs are taken, and the requirement that lethal drugs, about 100 pills in parentheses, are simply picked up at the local pharmacy. Two points raised by the Archbishop there. And can you speak to that, Brandy? First of all, you were just saying how it doesn't require that a doctor be present for this. I don't know, you know, yes, no, why that should be if a person is competent and has asked for the prescription, the doctors give it to them. What's done in the state of Oregon? Is that how done there?
Most often people want to spend their last moments with their family. This gives them the opportunity to do that. So we don't want physicians to have that additional burden of having to be there as well. Or maybe that's the reason you can't do it because your doctor can't be there. It doesn't have anything to do with your physician at that point. Okay. This is something between you and your family.
And the Archbishop's point about the prescription simply being picked up at the local pharmacy.
Well, tons of dangerous prescriptions are picked up at local pharmacies that could also harm other people. So there's no reason why this particular prescription should have any other,
requirements. Samantha Crane, you agree with the Archbishop on those concerns?
Yeah, although first I'd like to say that, Compassion and Choices says on its website that it arranges or participates in about 75% to 97% of all physician-assisted suicides in Oregon. So I would definitely disagree that this is a completely spread-out phenomenon or there's no doctor shopping. In 2014, there were 155 prescriptions prescribed by about 80 doctors. So it's not all that spread out, and especially when you consider that there's about 10,000 doctors in Oregon as a whole. But we are very concerned about the lack of witnesses. We don't necessarily think that it would have to be a doctor, but what we are seeing in Oregon is we have very unreliable and spotty information about the situations in which people are actually taking these medications. Once people get the prescription, they can go home and their condition can deteriorate, as that one caller mentioned, extremely rapidly. So if a person's family members are, basically administering the lethal prescription to a person who's not competent or not actively taking it, we will simply never know. They won't necessarily report it to the police that they did that. Unfortunately, people with disabilities and illnesses are at a very high risk of abuse, and usually that abuse comes from the direct caregiver who would be the only witness to this event.
Mm. Brandy?
I think that downplays the individual and knowing what they want. I mean, I think it's unfair to say that a person with disabilities or someone with a serious illness doesn't know how to make a decision for themselves.
If they've been determined competent, especially by, you said, at least two physicians, right? We'll come back and talk some more then. Brandy Alexander, Regional Campaign Manager for the Maryland Chapter of Compassion and Choices, supporting the Death with Dignity Act, and Samantha Crane on the phone, a board member with Not Dead Yet, the disability rights organization that opposes this. We'd like to hear from our listeners in the time remaining in this hour. 410-662-8780. Toll-free long distance for the midday show at WYPR is 866-661-9309. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Brandy Alexander from Compassion and Choices, an organization that across the country supports Death with Dignity. They call it Death with Dignity. Others say physician-assisted suicide. It's a law in Maryland, if it becomes a law, to allow terminally ill patients to get a doctor's assistance with death, with dying. Allow a doctor to legally prescribe a lethal dose to a terminally ill patient, a patient considered terminal within 6 months of life, the end of life. Samantha Crane is with us. Her group opposes this law in this state and other states. Samantha Crane with Not Dead Yet, a disability rights organization that opposes assisted suicide. Let's get more comments from our listeners here. Jonathan in Baltimore, you're on Midday Next. Hello.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
Dan, my mother is actually in a similar situation now. She's on hospice as we speak for a terminal diagnosis that will ultimately leave her unable to take her own life should she choose that as something she desires. Mm-hmm. I'm a physician myself, as is my wife and one of my brothers, and I think all of us support someone in her situation, having the right to choose their own destiny. And I think it's really not for us to start putting limitations on the rights of patients and really the rights of individuals. New Hampshire, the state motto is live free or die. I think the ability to take your own life is actually an innate human right. And for those of us that are unable to do that but are living in chronic pain or with significant illness that has degraded our quality of life, I don't think it's ethical for others to make decisions that preclude them from making these very personal decisions about whether or not they want to continue in this world.
Well, you've heard that, first of all, I'm sorry about your mother, Jonathan. I truly appreciate you calling in to give us your perspective as a physician. You've heard the concerns expressed by Samantha Crane that people can have a prognosis of, and come out of it, or it cannot. Sometimes they're not accurate.
I think that's understandable, but that certainly doesn't apply to all patients in that position, and I think, we make decisions based on the best information we have at hand. I understand, for instance, my mother's on hospice, and she was, because we didn't think she would live longer than 6 months, and now it turns out she probably will. And no one was wrong when they made that first generalized guess because, that's basically what we're making, our educated guesses. And, a lot of times we have information about median survival, which means 50% of patients will live longer and 50% of patients won't live that long. So, I think choosing the six-month mark is rather arbitrary. I know from my personal perspective with my family, it's more about quality of life rather than length of life, although I understand for drafting legislation, simplified metrics like that, are easy to use.
Mm-hmm. And from the physician's point of view, if you can separate yourself from son to physician, just to talk a little bit about that, How do you feel about having this power?
Well, I should say that I'm not a palliative care physician, and certainly those folks that are and do take care of people at the end of life are very special, both people and physicians, and I think almost universally they do an excellent job. And I think they're really, the ones that are experts in this more so than myself. I don't practice that type of medicine. I think as a physician, is not outside our purview in a way of helping folks. And I think as a son, I really respect the independence of my mother and whatever choice she would want to make in that situation. And I would certainly understand her and support her if that decision was that her quality of life was no longer such that she wanted to continue with us in this world.
Well, thank you very much for calling in, Jonathan. Thank
my
you.
Pleasure. Thank Thanks
you.
For having me.
Yep. Sorry about your situation, but I appreciate you sharing that with us. Can we go to Parkville and take Naomi's call next? Naomi, you're on.
Hi, Dan.
Hi. Hi. You have a question for our guests?
I do. Thanks for your show, and your guests both seem to have a lot of goodwill for the people involved, which I think is great.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the type of medication used in these prescriptions. If the Randy had mentioned that physicians wouldn't be present, and I'm just wondering, my knowledge of kind of the death row lethal dose procedures are that a physician has to be present just in case something goes wrong with the dosage or the medication doesn't work as planned. Is there any similarity kind of in the pharmaceuticals of the prescriptions for the death with dignity road and then kind of death row prescriptions? And then just a comment, I think that the value of caregiving can be really, really great. And I don't want to discount the value of caring for someone that has a you know, a terminal diagnosis. The value of their life, of course, I mean, we need to be sensitive to the pain that they're in, but they are also doing a lot of good for the people who are caring for them and who have the opportunity to care for them. And what resources are available to family members and people who are in those positions of caring for someone with that sort of terminal diagnosis.
Okay, Naomi, I'll let Brandy respond to that.
Sure. Well, for your second question, you can contact our organization at our 800 number, which I can give you. It's 800-247-7421, and we have counselors who are available to talk to not only people with terminal illnesses, but their family as well and their support systems.
That group, again, is Compassion and Choices. Now, her question about medication, how exactly is this administered? What is the prescription?
So the usually barbiturates are used, and there are clinical practice guidelines that have been developed, and they have found that those are the most successful. And usually you get the prescription, and it's mixed into about 6 ounces of a liquid and taken. So, yeah, it's barbiturates.
Does the legislation, the proposed law, require family notification? If, you know, my brother lives 3,000 miles away from me in California, and he decides to do this, and I don't know, he doesn't keep me up to date on his medical condition. He's a private person, but should somebody else in the family know? Does the law require that?
It doesn't. Okay. It's absolutely up to the individual. So some people have the family support, and I'm sure they would prefer it that way, but sometimes you don't have that. It depends on your specific situation.
Samantha Crane from Not Dead Yet, did you want to add anything to the conversation in the last few minutes here? Because I'd like to get a couple more calls in.
Yeah, so I wanted just to add that, you know, one, we totally agree that caregiving is an underestimated and undervalued activity, and that fortunately, we have a lot of programs, including the Medicare hospice care benefit, that can provide family members with respite and with assistance, giving in-home supports to their family members.
Okay, Samantha, thank you again. Let's go to Dan in Baltimore and get his comments on this. Welcome.
Hi, Dan. Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure.
I guess I just have a comment. I want to say that I understand that we don't want to encourage people to prematurely end their lives if they can outlive a disease, but you know, if I have a terminal diagnosis, I can choose to fight it, I can choose to try and outlive it, but what if, depending on the pain I'm in, maybe I don't want to put my family through that pain? And I guess who can say that I don't have the right to end my life with dignity? Because effectively, by doing so, they're saying that they're forcing me and my family to suffer through unnecessary pain and incur unnecessary costs, as well as a degradation of quality of life that I don't want to suffer through. Mm-hmm. And why don't, you know, how can we say that you can't end your life on your own terms and you have to go through that pain and suffering?
Thank you very much, Dan. Thanks for your comments. Amanda in Odenton. Go right ahead, Amanda. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I just want to comment on the Archbishop.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
You know, stance on what's going on. He's, you know, giving these things about how he disagrees with it because there's no physician and nothing like that, but I think it's actually probably he wants to seem open-minded, but he just wants to kind of push his religious stance on that because Catholics generally believe that any type of suicide is wrong and is, you know, not, quote-unquote, God's will. So, but at the same time, as someone that grew up Catholic and does have faith, but I understand that it's not my place, even though I actually agree with this bill, that it's not anyone's place to push their religion on other people. So I just feel like he's just trying to take this stand with his religious views, but yet not say it's his religious views. And I also wanted to just comment to Samantha. I'm actually a special educator, and I understand your point of view on, you know, not wanting these individuals with special needs, especially people that are ID, to be abused in this way. But at the same time, as an educator, I see kids that are in group homes and things like that are getting abused in their everyday lives. So it's, you know, this one specific thing isn't necessarily going to stop the widespread abuse that is already out there.
Thank you, Amanda. Samantha, did you want to respond to that?
Yeah, actually, in my day job, I'm the policy director of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network, and I absolutely agree that people with disabilities are abused in day-to-day life, but that's exactly why we're extra concerned when that abuse can have fatal fatal results in the case of physician-assisted suicide. And it's not just people with intellectual disabilities that I'm worried about. Actually, most people in Not Dead Yet are people with long-term physical disabilities who are very concerned that, you know, they have experienced periods of depression. And if they came to a doctor and, you know, expressed an interest in dying, it would often be interpreted less as a cry for help or an expression of depression, but as a request for physician-assisted suicide. So we're very worried that people with disabilities and people with illnesses are just not getting the level of suicide prevention resources that other people in our society take for granted.
Samantha Crane with Not Dead Yet. Thank you very much for being with us today. And we posted an essay about the disability rights movement, the opposition to assisted suicide, on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, and you could read more about their position there. Thank you, Samantha, for being on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yep. Let's take another call. Mike in Manchester. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think one thing's missing from this discussion, and that is the profit motive, the incentives that drive behaviors and decisions, including care providers, insurance companies, archbishops that speak on behalf of hospitals that the Catholic faith has and profits from. I think it's a travesty that we don't look at this question and the decision and the ability for people to make decisions to affect the quality of their life and to end it with dignity and respect. People have that right today. They can hop in their car and get into a collision, and that ends it all. So it seems to me we ought to take it logically. We ought to consider the profit motive and incentives. And I would ask for your speakers, and Dan, for yourself as well, to address this point in this important discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is that something you raise at the in Annapolis? I wonder about that because it takes us back to the debate over Obamacare and the use of the phrase death panels and all that. But that's not an argument that your group makes, Brandy.
It's not.
A question that came up on Twitter about money earmarked for assessment of competency to make this decision. The business of the aspect of determining competency of a patient, that's on them to make that determination, right? To get two doctors' opinions saying, yes, I am competent enough to make this decision. Correct?
Right. It's if the physicians feel that there is, there may not be competency, that's when a healthcare professional is added to the equation.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much. You know, as to Mike's point, that's a very hard thing for people to talk about and fathom, because it did get all mixed up when the phrase death panels came out of the arguments over the Affordable Care Act. But it's something we can address and should address intelligently, perhaps on another day. It's not an argument that your group makes.
It does not.
Okay, where does this stand now, by the way? There's been some hearings in Annapolis. What's the latest on this?
Tomorrow, actually, will be the Senate hearing at 1 p.m. If anyone wants to come hear more about this debate, there will be individuals with terminal illnesses telling their story, as well as caregivers who wish they would have had this opportunity, and other leaders in the community.
That is the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee meeting Tuesday, March 10th, right? You know what time did you say?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you, Brandy Alexander, for being with us, a regional campaign manager for the Maryland branch of Compassion and Choices. You can find a link to their organization on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page as well. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to our first hour today. We're going to take a break here for lunch and then bring you a second hour of midday. Monday's lunch is provided by Rosina Gourmet since 1999. Rosina Gourmet has served handmade, locally sourced ingredients for their very good sandwiches, soups, salads, and vegetarian items. You can find them on the web. They have catering available by visiting rosinagourmet.com. Stay tuned for the news.